New federal lawsuits from Flint residents over dirty water. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, legal action over the Flint water crisis. But first, to reaction to Paris in Michigan. In the wake of Friday's deadly terrorist attacks, Governor Snyder says he is halting his efforts getting Syrian refugees to resettle in Michigan. That's after earlier this fall when he said he would ask permission of the federal government to welcome refugees fleeing violence in the Middle East. In a moment, we'll talk to Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He spoke with Snyder earlier today. But first to Steve Tobachman, Director of Global Detroit. Now, Steve, your organization helps, as you put it, welcome, retrain, and empower immigrants. What is your response to this decision by Governor Snyder?
Well, we've worked very closely with Governor Snyder in making Michigan a very welcoming place to immigrants and refugees because we see it as critical to the economic future for the state of Michigan in that, you know, immigrants create jobs, they don't take them. And what we've seen is that in parts of the Michigan economy where immigrants have participated, we've seen significant growth from agriculture to manufacturing to retail services and high tech. And so we certainly were grateful that the governor talked about welcoming refugees in the fall. And we stand with everyone across the world that really is shocked, just horrified by the events in Paris. I'm not sure in terms of pausing refugee resettlement and security clearance what the governor knows that the public doesn't know. Thus far, the flow of Syrian refugees to Michigan has been but a trickle because of the intense and elaborate security clearance processes the U.S. government has put in place. I'm sure we will learn a lot more about the details of the terrorist attacks in the coming days, but it's not clear that that we need to overhaul the security clearances that are pretty intense as it is. We also look forward to hearing more details from the Snyder administration about what concerns there are. But ultimately, we believe that, you know, that there's a historic role that the U.S. and Michigan play in dealing with refugees and global suffering, and that, you know, the refugees that have been coming thus far, the 100 or so Syrian individuals already resettled in Southeast Michigan, you know, largely were fleeing the exact violence that we saw over the weekend.
So then how does this decision, the decision by Governor Snyder, impact that feeling, that hope that you're talking about, that Michigan can be a welcoming place for immigrants fleeing violence?
Well, given how horrific the events were over the weekend, I think that it's appropriate to ask questions to make sure that refugee resettlement is happening with appropriate security clearances. It's our hope that if we are indeed pausing any refugee resettlement, that it be done with an eye to resolve those questions as quickly as possible. And hopefully that can be done in a matter of days, if not weeks. And that the reality is that we were led to believe that the security clearance process for those who are going through the refugee process was fairly intense, and that the folks were under rigorous scrutiny. You know, the reality is that Metro Detroit, for example, has played an important role in helping Christians who were being persecuted in Iraq, who couldn't be anything further from the kind of terrorists that the Islamic State is talking about, and in fact have been on the front lines of fighting it and suffering. And we certainly need to stand with those allies and be united, as opposed to saying, sorry, we're not going to be part of anything that goes on in another part of the world.
And now, so the effects. What do you think the effects of this decision will be?
Well, I don't expect that you'll see this decision when that this decision is a long-term decision for the state of Michigan. I think that what Governor Snyder will find and what other things we'll find is that indeed the U.S. government has been doing everything within its power to check the backgrounds and to vet the refugees who are accepted for resettlement. But, you know, the reality is that I don't expect that somehow Michigan is going to take a stance that would be in contradictory to other states in the union about working with the federal government through the refugee resettlement process. I don't expect that that's where Governor Snyder is intending to go. I think that we are literally you know, just hours away, probably less than 100 hours away from some truly horrific events in Paris that are shocking and do call us to make sure that what our approach is on the issue of refugees as well as really homeland security are appropriate. So we look forward to letting the security experts handle the crisis and feel that, you know, that Michigan can continue to be a welcoming state, a nurturing state, an inclusive state that will create opportunities for all of us.
Steve Tabachman, Director of Global Detroit, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And now to Rick Pluta, who spoke this morning with Governor Snyder about this decision. Rick, what did the governor have to say?
Well, Zoe, he sort of clarified the position that he staked out over the weekend regarding putting a pause on the state's effort to attract Syrian refugees, to relocate Syrian refugees to Michigan. He said that there is still a moral imperative, that there's still humanitarian reasons to bring in refugees, but also practical reasons. I mean, remember, Michigan lost population during the Great Recession. And so, I mean, this is just one of the things that he had to say about it, trying to sort of put his directive into context.
Most people are not terrorists, and we need to be thoughtful about helping people around the world. This is just to be prudent to make sure that some terrorist element is not entering our country.
And so he said that the state police, maybe other state agencies are in discussions with the Federal Department of Homeland Security to just review their procedures, their processes, and making sure that they're doing everything that they're supposed to be doing. I mean, the big question is, you know, what is the practical effect of the governor's decision?
And what did he have to say about that?
Well, it sounds like that the real effect is that what's on pause are discussions with refugee private service providers, relocation agencies that are supposed to be making plans to be, you know, helping bring refugees from the Middle East to Michigan. Remember, the Obama administration wants to relocate 10,000 refugees from Syria across the country in the coming year. And, you know, Governor Snyder has said that Michigan should take in a sizable number of those. And it doesn't sound like that is changing. In the short term, we do not have a flood of Syrian refugees, of Middle East refugees coming into the country or into Michigan. The process can take a year or 2 years, that there's a lot of vetting that goes on, that there is a group of Syrians that are due to arrive in Michigan very soon, about 20 or so. This does not affect their relocation at all. And so we'll see what happens as, you know, these discussions and policy developments go along in the coming months, that this really doesn't have any immediate short-term impact. We'll see if there is some longer-term impact.
Right. This idea that this is not a permanent decision, just temporary. But do we have an idea of what temporary means exactly?
No, we don't. That supposedly the governor has requested this review, or maybe this review is going on. We don't even know that I haven't been able to get through to the Department of Homeland Security yet to get a clarification on that. And if there is a review underway, we don't know if this is something that's going to take 48 hours, a week, or whatever. But the governor said that he wanted to make clear that at some point the intention is that the effort to bring Syrian refugees, Middle East refugees fleeing violence from that part of the world here to Michigan.
Rick, I think one of the interesting things to note was over this weekend that folks were surprised by this decision by the governor, because mm-hmm. Snyder has in the past, as you and I have talked about, likes to call himself one of the, you know, the most pro-immigration governors in the entire country, whether that be Democrat or Republican. So I think it's fair to say.
Actually, I know this from experience, that if he were here, he would correct you and say, no, not one of. He would say he is the most pro-immigration governor in the United States.
And yet here he is, one of these Republican governors. And there are others. And I think that's why we're paying attention to this fact that Governor Snyder is one of the Republican governors making this mm-hmm. declaration because of exactly what you just said.
Well, there are the concerns over public safety, and I imagine that Rick Snyder might be a little chagrined at being lumped in with these other governors, like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal,
Texas,
who actually said that, you know, that Louisiana authorities should seek out and find relocated Syrian refugees in order to, you know, to keep an eye on.
Yeah, that was quite the statement from Jindal.
And so he's taking a very different approach, which is just, you know, we're going to pause, we're going to check things out, make sure that we are using best practices, that Department of Homeland Security is using best practices, and then we will resume our efforts to welcome immigrants, including refugees from the Middle East, to Michigan.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, also my co-host of It's Just Politics. Rick spoke with Governor Snyder earlier today about his decision to temporarily halt Syrian refugees from settling here in Michigan. Rick, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Still to come, sparking conversations about the end.
It's uncomfortable for us to talk about end-of-life care because it means admitting the fact that all of us are going to die someday.
That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
Remember that famous old declaration from Henry Ford about his Model T? The one that went something like, you know, customers can have it any color they want, so long as it is black. Well, our partner in The Next Idea, Ross School of Business professor Jeff DeGraff, says this approach to creating products is truly a relic and that ideas and creations should be shared. For our latest Next Idea segment, Cindy spoke with Jeff about just how the open source movement can boost innovation here in Michigan.
Jeff, just what is open source innovation exactly?
Well, it actually comes from a very old person and an old idea, Benjamin Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin famously said, some ideas are too important to protect. And of course, he invented the lightning rod and the Franklin stove and bifocals and things that he didn't patent. And Franklin's idea was the collective is smarter than the individual. And there are certain things that become cornerstone innovations upon which other innovations are built. And a good contemporary example of that is the Internet. The Internet was originally built as something to move data for the Department of Defense, mm-hmm. And of course became this incredible bit of commerce. Same with our satellite network, which became global positioning. And if you're driving your car with a with a map, these are the kind of the technologies you build on. So all open source is saying that when you create something, you protect it in a way that everyone can use it. There's no discrimination against people who can use it. And the object is we build on top of it.
And so it's looking outward instead of going inward. And so you're open to all kinds of ideas.
Yeah, but I don't want to make it sound like you're overly altruistic. The object is there are certain foundational technologies upon which you build other technologies. And certain geographies have done a brilliant job of kind of creating these open source institutes upon which other things are built. So there was one in Silicon Valley in the early days, which created a lot of the coding and software that people use to create our modern world. Of course, the same in the Research Triangle in the Raleigh-Durham area, mm-hmm. which became a lot of our biotechnology. So this is foundational work upon which other work can be developed. Applications could be developed. Now, let me just give your listeners a brief overview of how innovation works. There's usually three stages to innovation. The first stage is often referred to as blue sky research, and that's where we're unlocking the secrets of nature. Then the second stage is usually what we refer to as technology transfer, where it becomes a hard lumpy object or a mirror, you know, or a molecule or something. And the third stage is usually the development of an application. Now, what open source basically is saying that about the first stage and about half of the second stage, if you do this communally, it creates a lot more opportunities in the second half of the second stage and the third stage.
And you, as you say in your essay, you need to take a lot of these traditional approaches to creating and production, like the Model T and black, if you want it black, that's all you can get. You got to dump those in the trash can of history because?
I want to give you a great example of this. I was an advisor in the early 1980s, it's something called Applied Integrated Systems at Apple. Now, I'm there when Steve Jobs is being pushed out. And this is a very interesting time because Apple basically can't create enough software to compete with what's going on at Microsoft, right, with that platform, with that joint venture with Intel. So the object is Apple has to come up with a way of creating a lot of software very quickly. So what it does is it creates this thing called AppleNet, which eventually grows into a version of it, becomes iTunes. But what AppleNet is basically it creates a code kit, a compiler kit, and it puts it on what was called at the time intranets. Because remember, the internet, we're a decade before the internet. And what it does is it allows people who are software developers to develop applications on top of this kind of standard kit. It also, in this network, had venture capitalists. And those who know about the venture capital community, this is where Kleiner Perkins, is a very famous venture capital group, really kind of got its traction with Apple back in the old days. And so this network, this community of people who used to kind of be hippies and, they started developing software. So Apple had enough software collectively to compete with Microsoft because it had a communal view.
And for consumers, you point out, consumers become not just passive recipients, but active co-creators.
Oh, that's the big change. I mean, that's what millennials have brought to the game. You know, there are these two basic views of innovation that corporations have. The first is called push forms of innovation, and that means I develop technology because I'm, a technologist and I'm smarter than you are. And so I try and align all that and optimize it so that at the beginning I run a lot of experiments. I spend all my big money at the end. And it assumes that there'll be a market there for my really cool technology. Well, there's a problem with that, and that is if I'm building something that people don't want or taste change, that's a real problem. So a real good example is General Motors had built this plant in Kansas City to make Grand Amps, and they were super efficient. They made a zillion of them, but nobody wanted Grand Amps. So now you've got, a car that's basically devalued in the marketplace. So the problem with push is that you don't know what people want. The other form is called pull. Pull means you listen to what customers want. But it's easy to build a business if you listen to what customers want. But here's the problem. The problem is customers want different things. And so what you get is what's called product bloat. So you get a lot of different products and you get what's called feature creep, which means you get a lot of features that are different and you have a lot of what are called legacy products. So it means you got a lot of stuff that you built for different people that you have to end up supporting because you have too much variation. So the good news is you've got a lot of market penetration, but you don't make a lot of money.
So what's the...
So the third is participation, which is what's happening these days. And it's not just happening with things like software and Airbnb. It's happening with things like Boeing. So Boeing is going in and making their new Dreamliner, and they're not just making it in a push way. They're actually working with the major airlines and saying, what do we need to do in order to make this Boeing work for you? And it's not only allowing them to customize things in a mass customized way, but what's also interesting is it's collapsing how they manufacture things. So in the old days, you made a CAD-CAM drawing and you put it through a bunch of tests, you built a bunch of prototypes, and eventually you built, a fuselage and you made an airplane. But now they're doing things called 3D printing, where they're actually making custom parts for things and they're making them out of different materials in different ways. So what's happening now, even in very complex industries, and I include pharmaceuticals in this, I include heavy manufacturing, there's participation from the client.
And you point out in your essay the healthcare industry could stand to borrow from this.
Oh my goodness. Isn't that the whole notion of customer experience or patient experience is mostly like the woman at the airline counter or the man at the airline counter who basically is really nice to you but doesn't get you a seat on get you where you want to go, right? That's what happens when you go to a medical center. Now what's beginning to happen in some medical centers, places like the Mayo Clinic is a good example, where people are allowing patients to participate not only in a treatment plan, But the specifics of that plan, you know, what kind of, you know, what kind of a joint do you want? What kind of valve do you want on your heart? You know, here are your choices. And there's some customization that goes on with that as well.
How would we know that? How do we as the consumer know what we want or what we should have?
Well, there's kind of two parts to that, isn't there? And that is there is the need for intermediaries or guides. You know, think of these are the Tenzing Norheys, the Sherpas mm-hmm. that help Edmund Hillary, Sir Edmund, get up to the top of the hill. So as a patient, we're not going to know all the specifics of, you know, cardiovascular surgery or whatever it is we're going to talk about. But we need somebody who actually can translate for us. So think of these like ambassadors or emissaries. That's the first piece. And then the second piece is the provider needs to know more about us. It's not one size fits all anymore. Mm-hmm. So think about it. Even like your credit card, you know, your American Express card, there's like, you know, six different profiles. It doesn't have to be 6 million, but basically what kind of a card holder are you? What do you do with your credit? And they're going to optimize their solution to the type of person you are and the type of result you want.
What's the challenge here?
Complexity. And the challenge is, are you willing to put tools in place that can manage complexity, which, of course, with big data and kind of the pervasive net and the cloud is all happening. And it's happening in a way that's happening very quickly. And a lot of companies are very uncomfortable how quickly it's happening. It's creating also what's called data symmetry. And what data symmetry means is in the old days, the company knew a lot more about something than you did. But what happens when you know as much about the about what's going on as the company does? In some cases, more. Data symmetry means that they don't have power over you that way anymore. So that's what's changing. And the second thing that's changing is we need to train people not just in these very specific domain expert areas. We need to train people with more range about how to connect dots. So think about this. When you go to a medical center, there's somebody who knows everything about the heart and radiology and oncology and every different thing. But it's hard to find somebody who's truly competent and has enough range to talk about how all those things to go together. And as a patient, that's what you care about.
You want your navigator.
You got it. As a customer, that's what you care about. And that's what millennials are teaching us. They're teaching us, I call it the Burger King strategy. Those of us that are old enough to remember, have it your way. It's the have it your way strategy.
University of Michigan, Ross School of Business professor Jeff DeGraff. And you'll find his essay on the open source movement at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. A Kaiser Health tracking poll recently found that 9 in 10 of us want to have end-of-life discussions with our doctors, but only 17% say they've actually had such a conversation. Cindy recently spoke with Washtenaw Health Initiative's Marion Udow-Phillips and University of Michigan Doctor of Internal Medicine Adam Marks about an upcoming program designed to spark that uncomfortable conversation.
This idea, Dr. Marks, of palliative care, of end-of-life issues, it's not new. Why do you think it is only 17% of the people in that survey say they've actually had the conversation with their physician?
It comes down to a couple different things. The first, and the reason that we're so excited about the new reimbursement plan coming out in January, was just that prior to this, we weren't reimbursing clinicians for their time. And we know that doctors already have a lot on their plate, particularly primary care providers who need to talk to you about cancer screening and are you watching your cholesterol and how often are you exercising and what about your flu shot? Asking them to sit down to have a conversation about preferences for care at the end of life while not paying them for that time was a pretty tall order. And we know, too, that these conversations take a fair amount of time. I can't sit down with you in 5 minutes and expect to have a substantive conversation about your hopes and fears for the future in that time frame. The other thing is that, by and large, physicians don't get a lot of training in having these conversations. And we're human just like everyone else. It's uncomfortable for us to talk about end-of-life care because it means admitting that fact that you mentioned earlier, which is that all of us are going to die someday.
And I have to imagine that for many physicians, it's just so hard to lay down their weapons, so to speak. Very, very hard to say the D word, dying, and shift the focus away from healing to helping their patient have a good death.
You know, it's interesting that you mention that, because when I do teaching at the medical school and at the university hospital, one of my main points is get used to saying the words death and die. Because I can't tell you how many times I have seen providers stumble over that word. And, well, again, this is something that we have to be more comfortable discussing. But absolutely, there is a treatment imperative in medicine. We can do so much now. And we get used to doing the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. It is much easier to prescribe a medication, to plan a procedure, to perform a surgery, than to sit down with our patients and families and asking ourselves, wait, how is this going to help us? Is this really in this person's best interest? What are our goals for medical care? And is this intervention going to be getting us closer to those goals or farther away from those goals?
Marianne Udall-Phillips, what about the patients and the loved ones? Because I know I have heard patients say to me, I know that I am dying, but my kids or my spouse, they want to keep trying new treatments. You know, we aren't talking about what's ahead. My wife won't let me talk about hospice care. So those old taboos are still alive and well, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. It's difficult for everyone to have this conversation. But part of what we're trying to emphasize is this isn't actually just about when you're dying. It's about when you get a serious illness. Your family needs to understand what your preferences are. How do you want to be cared for? That's what advanced care planning is about. It's about thinking about it now when you're healthy or before you're at your end of life.
What if you have no idea? I mean, as I sit here with you today, I'm facing kind of a cranky knee. That's all that's on my plate right now. I have no idea what I will feel like when, let's say, Dr. Marks looks me in the eye and says, I don't think there's any more we can do. I don't know how I'll feel. How do I know what I want?
Well, it's not really necessarily about what exactly you want. It's what your preferences are. So there are some great documents that have been developed. There's the 5 wishes form, and it really works you through a conversation about, do you want your family around you to be with you in the event of a serious illness? Do you want to be out of pain? Do you want to be cared for in certain ways? So you don't actually have to decide things like, well, I don't want to be on a ventilator.
Okay.
You know, you just have to talk about what kind of care you want. And I think that's an easier conversation to have, but many people don't know how to have it. They don't know where these forms are. They don't have that conversation with their physician, as Dr. Mark said. Mm-hmm. So we want to help people understand how to have the conversation with their families, where to get forms that work for them. Lots of choices.
I would agree with that. And the only thing I would second is that we don't want patients to feel like they have to make specific decisions about specific interventions. And so that if I am talking to you and your main complaint is a cranky knee, and we're trying to think about the future, it doesn't make sense to say, oh gosh, would you want dialysis or not? And what about a feeding tube? And what about a ventilator? What about chemotherapy? What I try to emphasize with my patients and families when we're doing this advanced care planning is simply saying, when you think about your future, what's important to you? What aspects of your life give it quality?
Right.
So that to say, what aspects of my quality of life am I willing to sacrifice for quantity? And which ones am I not willing to sacrifice? And so I'll have patients tell me, for example, you know, so long as I can recognize my family and interact with them, tell them I love them, then I would want aggressive medical care to prolong that life. And other people say, gosh, if I got so sick I couldn't take care of myself, if I depended on other people for personal care, then I wouldn't want that life to be prolonged artificially. So this is the kind of the broad kind of themes that we try to elicit early on. And then later, if we're faced with a decision, we can go back to those and say, well, gosh, you know, we talked earlier about how if you got so sick that you couldn't take care of yourself, that you weren't sure that you would want aggressive care to prolong that existence. You know, maybe that's where we're facing now. The other point that's so important about these, as was just mentioned, about having these conversations early, is we know that when we get in the hospital and when we're faced with a serious illness, up to 75% of the time, we're not able to talk with the patient about these things because they're unconscious, because they're so sick, they can't understand what's going on around them. And so we are looking to the family members to make difficult decisions about care. And these conversations go so much better when the families can say, well, we've talked about this, and this is what my loved one said, versus what we see all too often, oh my gosh, I have no idea what my loved one would want because we never talked about it. We want to relieve this burden of decision-making that the families so often are faced with.
Dr. Adam Marks is the medical director of Arbor Palliative Care, and he's also with the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Michigan. Marianne Udall Phillips is with the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation and the Washtenaw Health Initiative. And again, this event is tomorrow night, Tuesday the 17th. The film is Consider the Conversation 2, stories about cure, relief, and comfort. And then it will be followed by a panel discussion, including Dr. Marks and others who are well-versed in advanced care planning and end-of-life issues. All free, all open to the public, and you can actually go to WashtenawHealthInitiative.org and get all the information. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you for your time.
Still to come, an update on a possible federal lawsuit over the Flint water crisis. And then we'll learn about a fungus called coffee rust. It's attacking coffee plants across Mexico and Central America. Two Michigan professors are searching for ways to stop it. We'll find out more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. A new federal lawsuit says Flint's water problems are due to the negligence of state and local officials. Several families sued last week. They're seeking monetary compensation, a medical monitoring fund, and more oversight of Flint's water system. And today, more residents of Flint and groups, including the Natural Resources Defense Council and the ACLU, say they'll also sue if issues in Flint aren't resolved. Anjali Wykar is an attorney in the Midwest office of the NRDC. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah, so what are you claiming initially in this lawsuit?
Well, just to be clear, what we have issued is what's called a 60-day notice. Under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, which is a law that we would propose to sue under, citizens actually have an explicit right to sue the federal government for failing to comply with their obligations to provide safe drinking water. In fact, there's a specific carve-out under this law that authorizes citizens to do so. But in order to do so, the person who wants to sue has to provide written notice of intent setting forth the basis of the lawsuit. Therefore, the government's put on notice and essentially has an opportunity to respond within those 60 days. It's possible that the government will respond satisfactorily and actually provide specific information to us that would satisfy our client's interests here. And if that's the case, we're certainly happy to have a conversation about that. If not, we're ready to move forward on day 61.
Right. So that would be, as I understand it, probably sometime in mid-January. But in order for you not to then go along with this lawsuit, what would you need from the government?
Well, what we're looking for is an explicit affirmative declaration that the manner in which the government has been performing its testing obligations under the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Lead and Copper Rule were improper, and that moving forward, they are making assurances to follow the letter of the law. We're also looking for things like medical monitoring. We are looking for essentially overhaul and assurance of compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act.
And do you have a sense that this is something that the government will do?
At this point, it does not seem to be the case. I mean, this is obviously not a new issue. Flint residents have been dealing with this issue for over a year now. Many, many facts have come to light. So we do have sincere concerns that this lawsuit is absolutely necessary. Now, the Safe Drinking Water Act was designed precisely for this very reason, to ensure that governments are held accountable and have a clear set of obligations to provide safe drinking water. And that wasn't the case here. And the government seems to be turning a blind eye in acknowledging that it had any wrongdoing here.
So if these things that you are looking for in the next 60 days do not come from the city, do not come from the state government, help me understand then what happens after 60 days. What do you do next?
So what happens in 60 days is that we would file what's called a complaint, and the complaint would be filed in federal court, naming all of the individuals who are the recipients of this letter. And at that point, the case would move forward as a, you know, any federal lawsuit would. Now, just to be clear, what we're not seeking in this case is we're not seeking money damages. We're simply seeking affirmative injunctive relief so that moving forward, we have assurances that this absolutely never happens again. I mean, basically what this action is about is about holding the government accountable for failing to protect the public health of the entire community. And I think what this case also highlights really is a troubling trend in which the government essentially is willing to cut costs at the expense of its most vulnerable citizens. The residents of Flint have been suffering an intolerable amount of exposure in their drinking water and have not received sufficient amount of redress. And this has to stop. It has to stop in Flint, and it has to stop all over the country.
Okay. Anjali Weicker is an attorney in the Midwest Office of the Natural Resources Defense Council, one of the groups announcing today their plan to sue the city and state of Michigan if issues relating to Flint water aren't resolved. Anjali, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Okay, ready for an ooh alert. It is a fungus called coffee rust, and it's attacking coffee plants across Mexico and Central America. It has already caused more than $1 billion in crop losses and cost the jobs of many thousands of workers. Two University of Michigan professors have been studying coffee in Mexico for nearly 20 years. They are John Vandermeer. He's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology. His research partner is Yvette Perfecto. She's an ecologist and professor in the School of Natural Resources and Environment. Cindy spoke with them about how coffee rust spreads and how we can best put an end to it.
Let's start with, John, what is coffee rust?
Coffee rust is a fungal disease that attacks coffee. It's been known for quite some time in Asia. It was a devastating disease in the late 19th century in Asia. That's, as a matter of fact, one of the reasons coffee became so abundant in Central America and Mexico and Brazil also, because the disease was so decimating in Asia that they had to stop coffee production entirely. So when coffee came to the Americas, rust did not come with it. But then in the late 70s, early 80s, why it was detected in the Americas, and everybody became very, very upset, very worried about it. However, the late 70s, early 80s, and until about 2012, it was persistent in the area but never became a real big problem. The curious thing about the disease is that 2011, 2012, that was the year that suddenly it burst on the scene and became absolutely epidemic through all coffee production in all of Mexico and Central America and Northern South America also.
So it was on a low simmer for a number of decades and then kaboom.
Why is that?
Well, that's one of the things that we're trying to understand. And we think that there are several factors that might have contributed to that. Among them is the deforestation that's been going on at the landscape level throughout the region, because the rust is a disease that gets spread by wind. And so the more wind you have in the area, the more it gets into the coffee plants. And so with deforestation, you eliminate a lot of the barriers, potential barriers for the dispersal of the disease. That's one of the potential factors that have led to this, but also application of fungicides, because one of the things that we have discovered is that there are potentially a lot of mycoparasites, which are other fungi that can eat the rust.
So they're an enemy of the rust.
Yes, they are an enemy of the rust.
Which means they're the good guys.
Yeah. And if you apply fungicides that are general fungicides that kill all the fungi, they will also kill the beneficial fungi.
So what is your research drilling down and looking at?
As Yvette just said, we're trying to look at the mechanisms whereby this thing has suddenly come on the scene. And we have this mycoparasitic fungus, the fungus that eats the fungus, and we've discovered there that there's a small fly whose larva eats the spores of the fungus also. And so we have these two potential controlling agents there, which we feel have kept the disease under control for many, many, many years, but because, as Yvette says, because of deforestation and also because of the elimination of shade in coffee. Coffee is normally grown in shade, but since the 80s, where there's been a tendency to eliminate shade trees in coffee plantations, which, again, encourages the dispersal of the rust through wind dispersal.
Because there's two main ways of growing coffee, right? Sun and shade. And
yes.
When we saw the ads back in the 80s, the Colombian coffee makers had of Juan Valdez, and it was, that's the sun version.
Yeah.
What are the pluses of that approach?
The main reason why people do coffee monoculture, sun coffee, is to increase yields. New varieties of coffee that can be grown without any shade trees were developed in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s, and those can resist, have a higher resistance of changes in temperature and changes in humidity.
They're
and
hardier.
Things like that. They're hardier because they are exposed to the sun for more periods, then they produce more. But the problem is that you need to have like a technological package with the Sun Coffee because they produce more as long as you apply fertilizers, as long as you apply herbicides, because if you eliminate the shade, you have then all of a sudden you have a lot of sun hitting this ground, and that basically encouraged the weeds to grow. So you have more weeds, you potentially have more pests because it's a monoculture. That leads to an increase in the use of pesticide, including herbicides and fungicides, and also fertilizers.
It's very much, it sounds like a catch-22, the way this is working. But and you're doing your research at a farm in Mexico that does shade growing. How does that work, and what are the pluses?
The pluses of shade-grown coffee is most of the time the shade trees are actually legume trees, so they provide nitrogen to the soil. So like Yvette says, you don't have to use artificial fertilizer, and they contain all sorts of natural enemies of the various kinds of pests that are trying to attack coffee. For example, what we found in Mexico in our 20 years there, we found over 30 different species of insects that actually eat coffee, but none of them are actually pests. And the reason they're not pests is because they're under control of all the various natural enemies that exist in the shaded coffee system. Once you eliminate that shade, well, you're on the road towards creating new pests that are going to attack the coffee, which then are going to require you to spray insecticides and fungicides and things like that.
It seems like just a classic lesson in the importance of biodiversity.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Because in this plantation, like John was mentioning, the organic shaded plantation that we have been working on for so many years, there's a very high diversity of organisms. And that includes herbivores, but it also includes the natural enemies of those herbivores. And so we have been studying ants, for example, spiders that are natural enemies. Basically, they are predators of other insects, and how they can help maintain the coffee without a lot of pests.
How much shade coffee growing is going on? Has the push to produce more, has that led to way more sun farming than shade farming?
Well, there's a kind of an ebb and flow here. I mean, people get enthusiastic about sun coffee, and so they move towards sun coffee, but then it doesn't work so well, so they go back to shade coffee. So there's a little bit of give and take there. On the other hand, once you sort of commit yourself to sun coffee, you're sort of stuck, and that's one of the problems that some farmers feel. They committed themselves because, like Yvette says, they thought they were going to get bigger yields, which, by the way, didn't necessarily turn out all that well. But they committed themselves to sun coffee. Now they're kind of stuck with it. To go from sun coffee to shade coffee is not all that easy. It's possible, but it's not all that easy. Similarly, once you have a farm that's sort of in balance with nature, that's been there for quite a while, where you have a forest-like cover over the coffee, you have all that biodiversity. You have the system that's operating in a kind of a equilibrium fashion.
Humming right along.
Yeah, humming right along, you might say. That's true. And so once you start eliminating the shade, then you see the problems start emerging.
How concerned, Yvette, are the coffee farmers about keeping an eye on this great spike in coffee rust?
Very concerned. Actually, not just coffee farmers, but the governments as well, because coffee is such an important crop in Latin America. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most important export crops.
How much is at stake money-wise and job-wise?
Well, I'm not sure money-wise, but about 25 million farmers, small-scale farmers, depend on coffee. And especially the small-scale farmers that are living day-to-day, basically, they can't afford to lose money in their crops. And so when the coffee rust hit Mexico, we're more familiar with what's going on in Mexico, but this happened throughout Latin America. When the coffee rust reached such high levels, some of the farmers lost their entire production. There were figures of about 40% of the crop yield being lost due to the coffee rust. If you're a small-scale farmer and you lose most of your crop, basically you cannot survive. And so some of them have done is sell their farm or start growing something else. It has been a crisis. In Mexico, some farmers have abandoned their crops and basically tried to find jobs someplace else and in some cases moved to the United States.
John, what do you hope will come from your research, particularly in the short range as you try to tamp down this great spike in this fungus?
Well, first of all, I have to be honest, and I'm not sure anybody really understands the fungus all that well. And so our first result, I'm hoping, is that we'll have a better scientific understanding of exactly how the fungus operates so that we can make predictions about what's going to happen in the future. But if I were to make sort of recommendations at the present time based on what we already know, I don't have a lot to say to individual farmers, and that's really very frustrating because farmers really want answers to questions. So when a farmer asks me, what can I do about the coffee rust, about the best thing I can say to him is talk to your neighbors about what they're doing, because it's a regional problem and has to have a regional solution. So farmers as a whole, they have to get on board with reforestation. They have to change their pasture systems, their cattle systems, to silvopastoral systems, putting trees in the pastures. They have to change their coffee systems to shade coffee systems. But it's something that has to happen at a landscape level. It needs planning. An individual farmer is kind of stuck without being able to do much on his or her own.
I know that you take students down to this farm, and you've been doing so for quite a few years. And what are your hopes for these young people that you're working with and that you're teaching?
All the students that come with us, they usually come to do a thesis, to do some research. And they get, you know, because we have accumulated so much information in this particular area, they build upon what other students have done in the past, and they continue, you know, developing these different research projects. So one of the aims is that they will have a very good experience in terms of the research and a collaborative experience as well, because they share what they're doing with the other students. We spend the whole summer there, and they present their work. They consult with us and with each other. So they learn a lot from each other. But also I think it's a really good experience for them in terms of experiencing a different culture, being in a different country, seeing what it takes to be a farmer, to be able to produce, and you know what the knowledge that is behind producing coffee. Farmers need to know a lot about their system. They get to talk to people there about how they're producing coffee. They get to talk to the owners of the coffee farms, to the workers. And they go to town, have a good time in the town as well, and get to practice their Spanish, get to become friends with people in Latin America. And sometimes those friendships last for many, many years. They go back and visit them, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a cultural as well as an academic experience for them.
That you're hoping they're going to take out into their careers and into their universities as they move on and onward, right?
Let me add to that, too. I mean, it would be remiss not to acknowledge that the students have a huge impact into our own intellectual development and all the stuff that we've done in coffee, and I think it's reflected in the stories that have come out at the University of Michigan recently. I mean, the stuff that we've done is done with the students. The students are the ones who provide much of the intellectual input, much of the creativity, much of what we feel we've made advancements in is due to the students themselves.
If coffee rust is not curbed, if it continues to grow, does it threaten the entire coffee crop in Mexico and Central America?
I'm reticent to make any kind of predictions at all.
It's a broad statement, yeah. I understand.
I mean, that's the worry that everyone has, and I can say that thus far it looks pretty bad. I'm hopeful that it's not going to be all that bad, but I just can't be very positive about it at the present time.
And let me add that it happened before when the rust attacked coffee in Southeast Asia.
Yes.
It basically eliminated coffee production from the area. So historically, we have an example of that happening.
And it'll be interesting to see how long it is before American coffee prices reflect in a big way what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the economics of coffee at the international level is kind of complicated, actually.
Yes, very much. And I understand you're a biologist, you're working in the field and trying to do that. Well, it'll be interesting to follow your work, and we really want to thank you for sharing your experiences with us and your research with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
John Vandermeer is with the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and the program in the environment at the University of Michigan. And Yvette Perfecto is a professor at the School of Natural Resources.
And that's Stateside for today. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Ryan Grimes, Sean McHenry, Mercedes Mejia, and Shelley Smith. Joe Lindstroth is the producer of The Next Idea. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I am Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.